That 35 days worth of shutdown, that itself had an impact because there was cut back on operations. There was a portion of our crew, person of our staff that was furloughed, so weren't able to do that mission. So that work, I'll call it piled up, or that work continued to accumulate. So for that 35 days, there was certain work that we just couldn't do. So now shutdown's over, and folks assume, oh, it'll only take us 35 days to back that up. It doesn't. It takes much longer. That took us 35 days to get into that. It's going to take weeks to months beyond another 35 days to catch up on all that work, because all our regular missions are already here. We're already working those demands on the work crew. So I think our readiness has suffered. I wish I could quantify for that, but there's parts that weren't in the inventory, parts that weren't shipped, parts that are on a particular shelf. So readiness degrades somewhat. Most of our folks couldn't travel. Most of our folks couldn't engage with industry, couldn't engage with the community. So we have to go back and make all that work up. Well, that's on top of the regular work that we already have. So you can see how that compounds the demand on the resources. A good estimate as to where we're going to be able to recover for is sometime in the future. I know that's rather open-ended. Some of those gaps we'll be able to cover pretty quickly just because we'll prioritize those. Others, it's going to take us months to catch up to where we might not even be able to catch up to them until latter part of this summer.
New York Times, February 22nd, they kind of chronicled some of the whole service-wide of all the problems, aircraft maintenance,
right.
Liberty stuck in dry dock, the Polar Star, problems with parts inventory. Anything else kind of specific to Alaska that kind of falls in that area?
So I would say that those parts and supply, just-in-time delivery, you know, plagued the Coast Guard at large. You could probably accentuate that a little bit in Alaska because as we talk about those centralized warehouses, which are great for keeping inventory and knowing where the parts are, but now to ship them, it just takes longer for them to get to Alaska. So as they work through the backlog, we're just further down just because of the further separation from us and the supply point.
Is there going to be any sort of issues, though, as we move into the summer with kind of the height of the fishing season?
No, I don't think so. I think there's always going to be readiness issues, whether aged ships with the aged aircraft, all those are going to be there. I'm not forecasting a gap in capabilities or a gap in coverage for any of our Alaska units for any of the Alaska missions. That's going to require, I think, some of our maintainers to work more diligent on the preventive work that they've got, try to get their prerequisite work, that operational level maintenance done earlier than the depot level. We've got some depot level work that we've got ships going into the dry dock there in Ketchikan that kind of got delayed. Well, that, you know, pushes things back. Well, the ship's still functional. It just has some required work that it's going to have to get. We haven't lost any of those out of the system yet, and I don't forecast that being an issue for us this summer.
So what is happening this summer as far as operations? Anything new? Anything specific?
So our typical summer surge we've labeled for the past, since 2008, Arctic Shield. So that's a drive to seasonal surge capacity, surge efforts, typically in the higher latitudes because of the ice, the snow, the weather kind of keeps us out of those. I mean, we still function all year round, but we have much greater heightened activity, both commercially and public-private sector is always going to increase those activities as the ice recedes and the winter comes back into spring. We try to push into those communities. We're continuing to do that this summer. We'll be standing up a new initiative that we're calling a Maritime Safety Task Force. This is an initiative that was developed by Sector Anchorage that's going to try to put a Coast Guard team, 3 to 5 people for 2 to 3 weeks, I'll call it in 12 hub communities around the state, and then from there they'll try to push out into the outlying communities around those 12 centered hubs. Most of that will be focused on shoreside prevention, shoreside inspection, shoreside awareness. There's some of those communities we've not been into in 3 to 5 years. So trying to get visibility on what the prevention requirements are, what the state of their equipment is, usually oil and close to the marine environment, how well they're set up, how well they're maintained. Kind of give us a little bit of visibility on what's going to be required to continue to sustain those in the going for the going years.
Can you be a little bit more specific about some of the deployments for Arctic Shield? What's happening this summer?
So we'll have the first deployment will be 2 H-60s to Kotzebue, similar we've done in the past. So 4-month stint for them that'll run from the 1st of June, July, August, September through the 1st of October. That's our forward operating base that we'll do search and rescue out of, maritime domain awareness. We try to do some marine mammal surveys. We try to do some coastal surveys. We do some of our own pilot area familiarization with the new crews coming up. And so we'll have those crews coming up there every 2 weeks, and that'll run for the 4 months for the summer. There's a number of exercises that are spread throughout the state that we'll do in each one of some of those smaller communities. Try to invest local participation, local familiarization on what that initial Coast Guard response should be. We have a number of enforcement, inspections, regulatory requirements that requires to get in a number of those smaller communities, from small commercial fishing vessel exams, inspections, to some inspections that occur from accidents that have happened in the past, and potentially even accidents that will occur this coming summer.
And that's going to be my next question. What about setting up for spill prevention and response?
Yeah, so we've got a series of exercises that we run throughout the state that DP, the Office of Prevention here at the district, sponsors. Sector Anchorage and Sector Juneau run a number of their own smaller exercises. We've got one that will tee up specifically in Prince William Sound. BP will actually be running that port exercise this year. That'll run in October, and we've got a number of series of smaller ones that we run throughout the state. I can provide you a list of those from our planning shop if you want to kind of get the specifics of which ones are there.
Sure. And what about deployments of the Healy or the Polar Star? Is that expected for the summer?
So Healy will be back this summer. They'll be up for their normal three phases worth of science, working for the National Science Foundation, working for NOAA, and working for Navy Oceanographic Section. They'll continue those efforts. We're going to try to use their presence to do some other enforcement and fisheries exercises, try to get the Hilo land out there just for continuity of operations, if you will, Bering Straits and north. The Polar Star isn't coming back. They're only going to be doing Antarctic, so that mission will always go south.
Okay.
Just because of the level of work that they have to do every time they come back. It's a huge dockside availability, so that'll run right up to the deployment time next year.
Just because it's such an old ship and they need
a lot of maintenance, so lots of work has to be able to put it to be able to turn back around and single ship, single point of failure, if you will, on resupplying McMurdo. Coast Guard's efforts to try to revamp that fleet. Commandant's working on the Polar Security Cutter replacement. I've got authorization for hull number one, so that's coming around. So there's some in the 19 budget. There's a little bit of money for long lead items for hull number two. Acquisitions, 4-year build plan, operational testing, so 4 to 6 years before we see that first Polar Security Cutter replacement. And it'll likely be going south to replace out Polar Star. Hull number two would likely be doing the same.
What happens, though, in the meantime, if something happens to the Healy or if some other vessel gets stuck or stranded up there in the Arctic? Yeah. What's gonna happen?
So great question. Unknown. So I don't have a Coast Guard resource, though, to be. I mean, if something happened today, could we get Healy underway early? They're finishing up some dockside work that what would prevent them from being accessible to that. Polar Star is just going into a major availability. It would be unavailable, so there'd be no Coast Guard resource that could provide that. If it's marginal ice, marginal conditions, perhaps I could get one of our coastal buoy tenders, the 225, to kind of come up there and do that. But that's 5, 10, 14 days, even if I was able to immediately send them up there. It would have to be contracted service. We'd have to rely on our international partners for that.
I know this might be a question that might be more in line for your superiors, but there are some critics that say that the United States, through the Coast Guard, is basically abdicating its role, its interest in the Arctic. How would you respond to that?
So I would say absolutely not. So there's some access that we're prevented from doing. And so in the middle of the winter, I don't have an ice-capable, ice-class ship strong enough or large enough to be able to move into the Arctic at a whim, at my own decision, at the bright or the heavy ice season. But that doesn't mean we're not there. We have opportunities to fly helicopters there. We have shoreside folks there. That maritime piece wouldn't be there. I think that's a disservice, I think, to the rest of the country, because we don't have a Coast Guard presence there. We don't have a U.S. sovereign presence there. I would tell you that the Air Force flies regularly. The Navy flies regularly. So we have U.S. presence there. It's just not as visible as a maritime asset from a Coast Guard cutter perspective. I think trying to make it a priority to recap the Polar Security Cutters, I think the current Commandant has done incredibly well to get those on budget and convince the Appropriations Committee to fully support that. We've been asking for that recap program for years. There's a larger, call it national interest on whether or not they want to try to support or push that. I think it's finally gotten enough pressure and enough interest that's where the funding for halls 1 and 2 are coming from.
I've heard some talk that if you folks hadn't got the funding for hall number 1 and a little bit for hall number 2 this time around, the program would have been dead.
Dead. That's a pretty drastic term. I think it would have been highly suspect, highly in jeopardy. But I would tell you, 2 years ago, we didn't have a funding for Polar Security Cutter or an icebreaker recap, yet we've been asking for it. So now it's come back along. I think both on the House and the Senate side have recognized the value, the importance of somebody being there. Coast Guard, I think, is that central location, needs to be there and show that maritime presence. And the Commandant has testified on that, both on the House and Senate side just here recently, and even made it a portion of his State of the Coast Guard address just most recently. And I thought, how very apropos that he had Senator Murkowski sitting in the front row in that presentation that he made down in Long Beach.
The two new icebreakers are what they're called, security cutters.
Polar security cutter.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Which I think is kind of, it sounds like that's kind of a way to rebrand it so that it's not so associated with climate change issues. Any idea of what their deployment might be? Would it be alternating back and forth between the Arctic and Antarctic, or would they be?
So great question. A little hard to say at this juncture so far out, but I would tell you that the resupply of McMurdo would be a priority mission. That's where we've already agreed to do that with Polar Star. That's the first hull to come offline on the Polar Security Cutter perspective would to do that mission. There's obviously some requirements for us to be up in the Arctic. I think Healy can cover down on some of those for right now, but eventually we're gonna have to be pushing into that space just because of the increased activity, whether that's the Northern Sea Route or the Northwest Passage or other activity, call them ecotourists or tourism at large. That activity is increasing. I mean, even our own energy exploration is going to continue to increase, north of Alaska. That's going to require Coast Guard presence to be there. That increase activity requires the Coast Guard to be there. Which one of those polar security cutters would be able to drive into that space? Would it be the first one? Would it be the second or third one? More so probably toward the second or third one than the first one, because I think that mission down south takes a priority. It's interesting to me when you walk through the requirements of an icebreaker versus the term that the Commandant has coined, the polar security cutter. My perspective is it's a Coast Guard cutter first. It has a job, a requirement to do all 11 of our statutory missions, not just icebreaking. Icebreaking is a capability that ship can do. That icebreaking allows it to execute any of those other statutory missions that we would have to do. So should it be armed, should it be capable of launching a boat, recovering an aircraft, doing law enforcement, doing prevention work? Absolutely. That's where I think the name, and is it kind of just a push to try to change the tune? I don't think so, because the requirements for us to be there are certainly only going to increase, whether that's the diminishing the ice there, the broadening of the shoulder seasons when the ice causes more activity to go. That's just going to require the Coast Guard to be there more often.
Instead of temporary deployments, how about a permanent presence in the Bering Sea and the Arctic coast?
Yeah, so the Coast Guard is very expeditionary in nature. We're going to go where the activity, where the demands are. I have a hard time understanding why would there be a permanent presence in any one particular location or place, because we're going to draw those resources to wherever the demand may be. And when I talk Arctic, Matt Bell here in Alaska, it's not just about in ice-laden waters. There are many Arctic missions, that's Bering Sea, Aleutian Islands North, that requires that Coast Guard presence. Some of that's going to require it to push up into the ice, which is where the ice caping capability comes from. Otherwise, it can be as far west as the MBL to even perhaps as south of the Aleutian chain doing North Pacific Guard, that illegal, unregulated, unreported fisheries. Now, could I see the polar security cutter doing that? The design of the ship may not facilitate work in there, but that type of class of ship could eventually be pushing into that space, especially when we look at other capacities and other priorities, where if other ships are taken elsewhere and that's the only thing we have left, then I'm going to use it to the best of the ability where the demand takes me. Because of the area that we're covering, whether that's here north of Alaska or even as far north in the North Atlantic, those waters are going to require a Coast Guard presence. Who best to go there? And so if you're positioning yourself, locking yourself down to one location, I think is is myopic, and I think you're focusing on a single point of attack versus broad breadth of authorities that the Coast Guard has.
Do you need a deep water port in Northwest Alaska?
So I would use one, yes. So I'm always concerned about that when I look at the deep water access that we have in Kodiak and in Dutch Harbor, and going north from there, I don't have anything. So if we're going to continue increasing activity, increasing demand for Coast Guard there, whether that's for logistics or for port calls or for doing Coast Guard missions, we're going to have to do that. To be able to push a ship off of Nome or Kotzebue or off of Utsjavik and having to anchor out 2 miles offshore because the water's so shallow, that's very ineffective, very inefficient way to do our Coast Guard business. Some of that business requires us to be in the port, in the shore, and I would think as increasing activity goes, that's only going to push the demand for that. Is that a Coast Guard requirement? I would say, well, we have to have access to deep water to be able to move those ships around. I think the state's going to be in a tough spot with where the state budget's going, where industry development, where industry investments are going to be. So is somebody going to come out and be able to invest the millions of dollars that are going to be required for those ports? It's going to be complicated at best. But certainly, if it was there, would we use it? Yes.
Any new vessels or aircraft coming online here in Alaska?
So I'm real excited about where we're going with acquisitions here in the Coast Guard. So, we have our two FRCs that were done in Ketchikan established recently, so we're getting four more. So we'll have two in Kodiak, one in Sitka, and one at Seward. I think we'll round out that hull of six fast response cutters by 2026. That'll require us to do some build-outs in Kodiak, but also build-outs in Seward and Sitka, so that larger capable ship can moor into those two ports. We'll replace out Douglas Monroe and Alex Haley and Kodiak with offshore patrol cutters, the new OPC. So hulls one and two will be going to Los Angeles, Long Beach, and then hulls three and four will be coming up here to Kodiak. My guess is probably 26, 28 for those two platforms coming up. And then we've got a whole new set of aircraft, fixed-wing aircraft, replacing out the C-130s in Kodiak. So the H models will be going away, and we're bringing in the Js. We've already got two up there now. The third J will be coming next week. And then the next two assets will be down, and we'll finish out that fleet replacement by September, October. And then they should be standing fully the watch come November with those platforms. The Coast Guard acquisition for UASs, for the unmanned aerial systems, is on track. So we've already seen some bit of deployment for that last summer during Arctic Shield. We had, a UAS flying, doing mammal surveys, doing maritime domain awareness, which was the first time it flew in the Arctic for us last year. We've already seen great strides with those down south doing a counter-drug mission. I can only see that improving for just because of the length. I think it's got about a 14-hour flight time. So it can get up, and you don't have to worry about crew or getting in the bang. And so much, much more capable. Obviously can't do self-rescue, can't rescue people out of the water. But that provides you a great awareness, great intelligence, great survey of the area, and certainly cover a much wider area than what we're already doing.
UAS versus UAV?
So unmanned aerial system versus aerial vehicle. So it's just putting up the plane, but that ties into the rest of the cutter sensors. So that's a system of connections versus just the plane by itself.
What's the range of those?
I haven't seen the update for the new UAS.
Okay. Liberty was expected to be decommissioned and replaced by one of the newer, I think it's
FRC.
Best, yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
What's happening with that?
So all five of those 110s here in the state are eventually going to be replaced. So we'll have those six FRCs, and then I forgot to mention, too, we're going to bring in two patrol boats, up to 87-foot patrol boats. One will be in Petersburg, and then the other one will be up here in Ock Bay. So we'll end up with eight ships, six FRCs, and two of those PBs to replace out the five 110s that we have here in the state.
When's that going to happen?
So 2024, by the time we get the next FRC in the state, and then we'll round that out by 2026. I haven't seen the specific decom schedule for all the 110s in the state, but it'll kind of be a one-for-one. So we can't decommission the 110s until the FRCs are delivered here to the state.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Been a promise. So the Commandant made that in testimony. His confirmation hearings to pull into the job. Was asked to, no gap, so 110s can't go away until the FRC show up.
So Liberty and Anacapa are going to stick around.
Yep, they'll stick around until their FRCs show
up. That's why Liberty's in dry dock, so it can get that depot maintenance
done.
So it can continue serving until it's decom.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I was going to ask you about the impacts on operations, but if there's going to be no gaps.
Yeah, shouldn't be any gaps. And I say that, shouldn't be any gaps, but The 110s, maintenance heavy. They've been around for a while, used hard and impacted here in the state. So could I have a mission-limiting casualty on them? Wouldn't surprise me a bit. So will there be some gaps intermittent throughout the rest of their lifespan? I would say absolutely. That's why we're recapping them. We've got other ships that will kind of backfill as they come around. Hopefully none of them will end up with a catastrophic failure that ties them to the pier indefinitely. But, we've still got spare engines, in the inventory in the Coast Guard. We've got other critical spare parts that are in the inventory. Do we have them on the shelves here in Alaska? Not all of them. So could there be a 2 to 4 day delay as a ship generates one of those casualties? Absolutely.
And you also have the buoy tenders that could fill in.
Yep. So the 225s and then the 175 plus Elderberry, all those could fill in. Obviously not capable offshore for the smaller buoy tenders. And their aids to navigation, heavy lift capabilities, we can do boardings off of them. They're not fast. Some have a much higher seakeeping capability, but the small boat that they use isn't as capable as what's on the FRC, so not as effective. And certainly if we had to push off really quick for a search and rescue case, FRC is much, much faster. The 110 is much, much faster. But in a heavier sea state, maybe the 225 is probably a better capability. And each of those kind of stand that watch, the offshore patrol cutter, offshore cutter, response cutter, on a regular basis.
Okay. Something else that I haven't done a story on in quite a while. What's the status of the Bering Sea traffic lane implementation?
So PARs.
Oh, so Bering Straits PAR. So IMO approved off on that last year, and so we implemented that here just this past winter. And so agreed upon by the IMO, cooperative effort between Russia and the United States on that recommended traffic scheme off of the Bering Straits. Our next evolution is to take that one step further and to do an Alaska Arctic polar access route study to establish similar traffic, agreeable traffic scheme on the north side of Alaska. So that would be a partnership between us and Canada. Being able to do a similar corridor that allows us to be able to predict that traffic, especially the increase in traffic coming through the Northwest Passage, but it also allow Native communities, subsistence hunters to try to add influence where those safety corridors would be to help, in and around subsistence hunting, in and around that industrial traffic that's coming across the top of Alaska.
What have you seen so far as the that increase in traffic across the North Coast?
So I see more traffic coming via the Northern Sea Route, the western side of the Bering Straits, just because of the increased energy traffic that Russia's putting out. Our traffic that's associated with tourism, the work that's already going on at Red Dog, our work that's already going on Prudhoe, that traffic continues to be there. We're seeing an increase. We're seeing an uptick. I think over the next 6 to 8 years, there's going to be further increases as more of those permits are opened up, as more of that industry pushes into the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. We're going to continue to see that.
Okay.
There's also an increase in adventures. So just civilians taking ice-capable kind of sailboats and things like that, and making their way through the Northwest Passage.
That kind of puts you in a bind, though, because if they get into trouble up there, you got to respond to them.
Yes. Yep. Absolutely. And with or without capability. And so Healy's, when Healy's are there for the summertime, that's when most of that traffic is occurring. If it turns into a search and rescue case or requires a particular law enforcement or enforcement action, then we're going to task Healy to do that, and that the science mission will come to a secondary nature. So we'll go and do that. If there's a vessel that ends up in distress, the Healy would be directed to go take on that mission. We partner, we talk with our Canadian counterparts on a regular basis. They've got a number of ice-capable ships that work up on the Northwest Passage.
Okay. I've talked to a couple of your predecessors over the years, and they put a lot into cooperation with the Russian Border Guard, especially for search and rescue operations. What's the status of that now?
So we still cooperate. We just had a meeting of commanders. So my counterpart, Vice Admiral Tulloch, was here this past fall. We have a joint operations manual that we continue to update, continue to refine. I would tell you our cooperation's more connected, stronger on enforcement actions for fisheries along the maritime boundary line. That's the original discussion that came up. We're trying to now start talking to them about a cooperative on search and rescue, a cooperative on prevention efforts. That's a different part of the organization there in Russia. They've got three different entities that would control that versus the one for the Coast Guard that would be able to do all three of those. So that's requiring some additional context some additional conversations with our Russian counterparts. Our command center, we talk to the Russians regularly for operations, situational awareness, who's working that maritime boundary line, and that cooperation continues daily.
And finally, looks like I'm at my 30 minutes here, but before I go, is high seas drift net enforcement Pacific, is that still something that...
Absolutely. So we call that North Pacific Guard, and so we're continuing to do that. We have a ship that's going to deploy this summer in enforcement with North Pacific Guard. We still work cooperatively with Japan and Canada and China to facilitate the maritime domain awareness across the Pacific latitudes, and then we try to... get our folks out to interact with those fishermen just to understand what their pattern of life is, what type of fishing apparatus they have, and any of those typically that are violating the UN moratorium on high seas drift nets. So that will continue. We'll have an aviation asset that'll be embarked. We have fixed-wing aircraft that support that aircraft. RL craft, we're going to, again, stage them out of Japan later this summer to help facilitate a shorter travel, shorter transit back for them.
The aircraft or the vessel?
The aircraft, yeah. Okay. And we'll, my guess is we'll likely have a port call in Japan or two, because it's an incentive for the crew to be able to make that port call. Helps get them excited, and at the same time, that's a much shorter transit back to do logistics in Japan than versus coming all the way back to the United States.
But that will probably be a Hawaii-based cutter that will be doing that, right?
Not necessarily. So it'll be a 378, most likely high endurance cutter. Which one's scheduled to do it this particular summer? It could come out of it could be the Douglas Monroe out of Kodiak, or it could be a 378 out of Seattle. Mm-hmm. Could be one of the ones out of Hawaii. I'm not sure who's scheduled for doing it this far in advance.
Okay, well, that's enough for the time being. Thanks
awesome.
For talking with me.
My pleasure. Happy to do so.